Leslie Williams, and I'm co-chair of the Network Against Islamophobia, which is one of JVP's initiatives. And Carol Muskin over there is my co-chair with the Network Against Islamophobia. And so we'd just like to welcome you to this event. As many of you may know, in March, JVP launched this campaign called Defund Islamophobia in front of the offices of the Jewish United Fund right down the street from us. And the origin of the campaign was research that various people at JVP have done showing that although the Jewish United Fund talks a lot about its desire to reach out to different communities, to do anti-racism work, and to work against Islamophobia, that unfortunately, largely through their donor-advised funds, they've been contributing hundreds of thousands of dollars to organizations that the Southern Poverty Law Center has described as anti-Muslim extremists. And you'll hear some more specifics about those organizations and those contributions. And so we as JVP feel that the Jewish United Fund can't simultaneously say that it's fighting Islamophobia and fighting racism if it's also directly and indirectly actually funding racism and funding Islamophobia. So that's what tonight's program is going to be about. We have a couple of basic asks with the campaign. We realize that a lot of people in Chicago are connected to organizations that are connected to the JUF, and we're hoping that if you have connections to synagogues or organizations like Avodah or JCUA or other JUF-affiliated organizations, that you'll talk to people within your organizations about why you find this connection between the JUF giving and Islamophobia to be so troubling. So we have three wonderful speakers tonight who are going to explain this in a lot more detail. So to your left, to my right, is Stephanie Scora, who is also a member of JVP. And just knock my water glass over. Stephanie is a lesbian trans woman and an anti-Zionist Ashkenazi Jew, and whose activist work centers around Palestinian solidarity organizing, queering Jewish spaces, and fighting for justice and liberation for all trans people. She organizes actively with Jewish Voice for Peace and If Not Now, and is a co-founder and lead organizer for the Trans Liberation Collective in Chicago. When not organizing, Stephanie is a professional educator and trainer on topics ranging from gender and sexuality to Jewish theology and anarchisms. In the middle is Deanna Othman, who is with American Muslims for Palestine and also the Council of Islamic Organizations of the Greater Chicago Area. Deanna is a journalist and educator who has a religious column at the Huffington Post, and she's been published in the Chicago Tribune, the Chicago Sun-Times, and on Salon.com, Pathos, Alternet, The New Arab, and the blog Mondo Weiss. She also served as the assistant editor of Islamic Horizons magazine. Deanna currently teaches literature and journalism at Universal School in Bridgeview, Illinois, and she's a board member of AMP Chicago and the Council of Islamic Organizations of Greater Chicago. She holds a bachelor in English and International Studies and a master's in journalism from Northwestern University. And finally, on the other end, next to Deanna, is Terry Johnson from the Center for New Community. And you'll see that Center for New Community has done a lot of research on the Islamophobia network and industry, which is what Terry will be talking about. She is a Chicago native and has worked to level the playing field for people of color for over two decades. Born on the cusp between the baby boomers and Generation X, know how that goes. She uses creative approaches that bridge the gap between traditional and non-traditional, old and new. She is the executive director of the Center for New Community, which, founded in 1995, monitors organized hate groups and fights back to mobilize a powerful force for justice, fairness, and opportunity. Center for New Community tracks organized bigotry and equips grassroots movements. CNC's vision is the creation of a just society that values the dignity of all. Terry Johnson is also the founder of Sea Change Strategies, a social enterprise working with organizations to change their cultures, improve their communication, and strengthen connections to engage and transform communities. Ms. Johnson has worked in higher education, philanthropy, social sciences, social services, youth services, human rights, public health, and advocacy, and she's a graduate of Northwestern's. So we're going to start. Stephanie is going to kind of give you an overview of the campaign. Then Terry is going to talk some more about the background of the Islamophobia industry. And then Stephanie's going to talk a little bit more about where we're going with the campaign. And Deanna is going to talk about how the organizations that are being funded by the JUF, how they actually cause real harm to Muslims and Palestinians in particular in our community. So we'll do a little bopping back and forth. But for now, I'm going to turn the floor over to Stephanie.
So, yeah, I'm going to be talking to y'all a little bit about what the Defund Islamophobia campaign is, what it consists of, why we're doing it, and who the folks that are really causing us to target the JUF for some of these, let's say, less than savory donations. So the Defund Islamophobia campaign is JVP's campaign to get major Jewish... Oh, my phone flipped. Hold on a second, y'all. I'm sorry. All right, there we go. So it's JVP's campaign to get major Jewish organizations to, in this case, the Jewish United Fund of Metropolitan Chicago / the Jewish Federation of Metropolitan Chicago. They like to go by both names. To stop contributing money and other material support to anti-Muslim hate groups and Islamophobic groups and promoting Islamophobia in general. So we're seeking to shed light on the unscrupulous activities of the JUF, and particularly because they claim to speak for us as Jews and also the Jewish community of Chicago at large. And we're speaking against this because when an organization claims to speak for all Jews in the Chicago community and all Jews at large and yet promotes speech and actions that actually substantively harm communities that we stand in active solidarity with, we feel that it's our responsibility to come to these Jewish organizations and say, no, you're not going to do this in our name, you're not going to do this at all, and we're going to expose the stuff that you're doing and the people that you're giving money to and the hate that you're funding so that the world will know when you claim to stand with Muslims and you claim to stand against Islamophobia, might not actually be the case. And so we're also seeking to oppose these organizations' Zionist and Islamophobic actions and continue to draw a very firm link between Zionism and Islamophobia, largely that Zionism causes and promotes Islamophobia because it relies on Islamophobic tropes and anti-Arab racist tropes to exist and propagate itself as an ideology. So these JUF donations, what are they, where are they going, what's happening with them? We all know of JUF as a contributor that brands itself as giving large amounts of money to Jewish cultural causes and claiming to simply support the Jewish people, our culture, and our religion through substantial financial contributions to day camps, summer camps, afternoon camps, schools, congregations, festivals, basically anything Jewish in Chicago. JUF tries to put their stamp on it. Their logo is everywhere. They give money to pretty much everything. But the JUF also has some things that they don't really like us to know, and some things that they're quite proud of that we think are things that they really shouldn't be proud of. The JUF is also very well known for very, very heavily contributing to Zionist causes and heavily, heavily Zionist causes and doing so on purpose. And in many cases, they actually refuse to fund anti-Zionist programs or anti-Zionist organizations. Most recently, they contributed and sponsored and basically put on the entire show for this really awful event called Israel Solidarity Day. It was in Ravinia. They had this big thing. There were a lot of small children being indoctrinated there. They had the Maccabees. And it featured like a walk with Israel and a speaker who was claiming that the reunification of Jerusalem was something that Jews should be proud of. And JUF had their name all over that. So they very blatantly and very purposefully support heavily Zionist causes. So we did this investigation. Folks in JVP did this investigation and produced a report that shows that not only does the JUF support Zionist causes, they're also explicitly funding behind closed doors really nasty anti-Muslim hate groups, really, really nasty people and organizations that are leaders in the Islamophobia industry that you're going to hear a little bit about from the other two co-panelists and myself. So the JUF has donated over $783,000 over the course of 3 years that we were able to get documents for. This was 2011 through 2014, and 2014 was the most recent tax year that we could get a hold of. They contributed over $783,000 to a number of groups, but two in particular which I'm going to touch on in a minute. And these organizations and people are leaders in the Islamophobia industry. They've also, when we called JUF out on this, they denied knowing about these donations and knowing that these organizations were Islamophobic, saying that they just applied for money to do things related to the Middle East or related to Jewish safety and security policy. And we think that that's, you know, a crock. These organizations that have been receiving money from the JUF have been at their drivel since the mid-90s and all of the 90s in a very long time. So if the JUF didn't know that these organizations and that these people were Islamophobic, they didn't know because they didn't want to know. They didn't know because they chose not to know. And so we are sort of trying to shine a light on the fact that not only is the JUF contributing to these groups and giving money to the Islamophobia industry, they're also doing so for very established players in that industry and people and organizations that have been leaders in the Islamophobia industry for decades, doing this on purpose and giving large amounts of money that Jews have donated and that with that donation essentially speaks in the name of the Jewish community to these organizations. So I'm going to touch on the two biggest ones that we found who received this $783,000, and that is, the first one is a guy you might be familiar with, Daniel Pipes and the Middle East Forum. Oh, that is up there. Awesome. So between 2011 and 2014, the JUF gave $648,750 to the Middle East Forum, which is founded by this guy named Daniel Pipes. Daniel Pipes is a noted bigot, a proud Islamophobe, and also really hates trans people, too. We found this out right before the report came out, so we weren't able to put it in there. But he has called the acceptance of trans people a sign of the decline of Western civilization, which if I know that he didn't hate me for existing, I would really take as a compliment, because, you know, Western civilization isn't all it's cracked up to be. So Daniel Pipes in the Middle East Forum, he is just, Pipes himself is described by the Southern Poverty Law Center as an influential propagandist at the center of what is a large and evolving network of Islam-bashing activists. He is a leader in the Islamophobia industry. He does this for a living. He's a professional bigot, and this is what, like, this is his life. And the JUF has given over almost $650,000 to Daniel Pipes, who's been doing this since the 90s. SPLC also notes that Pipes, among other things, endorsed the internment of Muslims in America. He claimed that Barack Obama was a Muslim, and that Barack Obama enforced Islamic law and Sharia law. He sort of went back and forth on those two statements. I'm not sure if he knew that those were the same thing or supposed to be the same thing. And among other things, the Middle East Forum, under the banner of Daniel Pipes, successfully lobbied New York Life and Morgan Stanley not to sponsor future banquets from CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, which Pipes has falsely claimed for years is linked to terrorist organizations. We know that that's not true. CARE isn't linked to terrorism at all. That's silly. And so contrary to the Middle East Forum's smear campaign, CARE is a nationally recognized civil rights organization that has received praise from 17 U.S. senators and 85 U.S. representatives from both sides of the political aisle, and more importantly, community members and activists around the country and around the world who recognize that CARE does really important work in advancing the rights of Muslims in the U.S. and standing up for Muslim communities when they're so often maligned by folks like Daniel Pipes. And so most recently, actually, Pipes has praised 45's Muslim travel ban executive order and advocated in the Middle East Forum's publication, The Middle East Quarterly, for even more extreme vetting of Muslim immigrants through interrogation that included the use of, for example, things like lie detector tests, social media surveillance, and other forms of advanced screening for immigrants that other populations of immigrants would not be subjected to. And so the second group of folks that we're really going to focus in on here is Steve Emerson and the Investigative Project on Terrorism. Awesome. They are up there. So in 2012, the The JUF gave $26,000 to the Investigative Project on Terrorism, which Steve Emerson founded. Emerson is also identified by the Southern Poverty Law Center as an anti-Muslim extremist and as a leader in the Islamophobia industry. This is just as bad of a dude. So he, starting in the 90s, Emerson provided allegedly expert testimony in hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee and other official governmental bodies that essentially smeared Muslims, maligned Arab people more broadly, and advocated for policies and governmental decisions that would take away rights or produce increased surveillance policy targeting Muslims and Arabs. Immediately after the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995, Emerson claimed on TV that the attack had a Middle Eastern trait to it because it was done with the intent to inflict as many casualties as possible, which is something that's a ridiculous claim. And it's one of the most heinous statements that Emerson has made on record, saying that simply because an attack was high in casualties, that it was clearly perpetrated by a person from the Middle East. These are the sort of things that Emerson has been saying and has been saying to the government for many decades, and has been saying in an attempt to influence policy in the U.S. and in individual states. So in 2007, Emerson met with now White House Chief Strategist Steve Bannon to discuss Bannon's proposed film Destroying the Great Satan, The Rise of Islamic Fascism, which he spelled wrong, in America. So the proposal for the film lists Emerson as an executive producer. I have not watched the film. I would recommend that none of you watch this film and that you encourage all of your friends and family to never watch this film. So in 2015, even Fox News felt the need to apologize after Emerson claimed in an interview on the channel that Birmingham, England, and other European cities were filled with quote-unquote no-go zones where non-Muslims and government officials don't go. If this is a claim that you're familiar with, it might be because it was a cornerstone in some of Trump's anti-Muslim policy rallies, and also a cornerstone in some of the Brexit vote-leave campaign rhetoric as well. So we're focusing on these two particular individuals and their, I don't know if I want to call them contributions, their efforts in maligning Muslims and Arabs and in spreading Islamophobia, because we want to point out exactly who the JUF is giving money to, exactly the kind of people that the JUF is claiming speaks for the Jewish community, and the kind of places that the JUF has determined that they want Jewish money and Jewish donations to go to, particularly money from Chicago and the voice of our community in the Chicagoland area. We at JVP think that this is horrendous. We're continuing to call on the JUF to promise not to give money to Steve Emerson, Daniel Pipes, the Middle East Forum, or any of their associates in the future. And we're also trying to force the JUF to make this commitment a very firm commitment publicly to the community, because now that we know that they've been funding Islamophobia, we're trying to force them to defund it. We want to make sure that when organizations that claim to speak for Jewish people anywhere, but particularly in Chicago, put their voice out there and say, we speak for this community, we speak for these people, that they're not intentionally harming people who we work with in our everyday lives, communities that we hold dear, and communities that are being already maligned by not only the federal and state government, but by other communities of people who are being influenced by racist and Islamophobic policies that even some of which that Daniel Pipes and Steve Emerson have had a hand in creating. We do not want the voice of the Jewish community to be implicated and held unaccountable in this vicious cycle of hate mongering and of blood money. And we're going to tell you a little bit later about what exactly we're trying to do to stop them and what exactly the goals of this campaign are.
Good evening. So I want to thank JVP for inviting us here and allowing us to go on the journey with you as we work to combat Islamophobia and other forms of nativism. The Center for New Community has been around since 1995, And essentially, our goal is to make sure that we are paying attention to the organized racist movement so that we can give people the information that they need to push back and to make sure that the people who are, as Stephanie said, the professional bigots, don't get what they want. And so my job tonight is to try to provide some context for how we got where we got, and also where we are, and the organized and the operationalized hate that not only supports it, but feeds off of it. So where we are. The Council on American-Islamic Relations just released a report that said in 2016, there's a 57% increase of anti-Muslim incidents. And that's broadly defined. That would include the vandalized mosques, the mosques that have been set on fire. It would include assaults to Muslim men and women, but not particularly, but there is a strain of intensity in terms of targeting Muslim women. There also includes Muslims being illegally targeted for interrogation by the FBI and other state agencies. Another one of our partners, and CARE Chicago is a close partner in the work that we're doing. The SPLC, who's already been mentioned several times tonight in terms of their identification of hate groups, also collected between the day after the election and February 7th data that indicated there were 1,372 bias incidents. 346 of those were anti-immigrant, 260 were anti-black, 127 were anti-Muslim, and 116 were anti-Semitic. And SPLC also shared that the rise in the number of anti-Muslim hate groups themselves increased from 34 to 101 from the beginning to the end of 1 year, 2016. That's the largest spike since they started doing the tracking in 2010. One more data point. In Power, Pain, and Potential, the South Asian Americans Leading Together documented 207 incidents of hate violence and xenophobic political rhetoric that was aimed at South Asian, Muslim, Sikh, Hindu, Arab, and Middle Eastern American communities during the elections. 95% of those were animated by anti-Muslim sentiment. And notably, 1 in 5 xenophobic comments came from then candidate, whose name I can't say, number 45. And so while we're having this conversation of the steady rise in hate groups and the steady rise of hate violence and rhetoric, that's certainly the longest election season in my adult life, sparked in some ways, fed off of in some ways, and freed people to join in other ways, we have to remember that these groups preceded Trump and will be here long after 45 is gone. So we work at the intersection of this intersection, which is the Islamophobia movement and the anti-immigrant movement, and the backbone of that these modern-day movements that are related to each other and, again, connected to each other and feeding off each other and using a lot of the same language. And ultimately, it's all about making sure that people who some people believe shouldn't be here are focused on and targeted to make sure that they aren't comfortable and there are policies and habits and laws and cultures and neighborhoods, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that are going to make sure that we remain the predominantly white, predominantly male, predominantly straight, predominantly Christian community that the nativists want us to be. So let's talk a little bit about the groups. It's a $57 million network. So it's not just the arbitrary young man or young woman who've decided that they're going to take it out on other people. It is an organized movement. And I also want you to remember that 9/11 is not when it started. And so here are three of the major. groups. Forgive me, I'm going to have to step to the side for just a moment. David Horowitz Freedom Center was established in 1988, and that's an advocacy group. The think tank, Frank Gaffney's Center for Security Policy, was founded in 1988 as well. And then the grassroots arm of Act for America was founded in 2007. And Stephanie's already talked about Daniel Pipes and Steve Emerson, but there are other groups, and that's a smattering of the groups that include different attack zones, right? So some of them target campuses, some of them target laws, some of them target, so it's, again, it's a very strategic web and network, very powerful. And they often share mutual funders, and they're on each other's boards, and they work under the same umbrella organizations. They move from organization to organization. They author joint reports. They appear together on panels and public events and on television shows. Many of them coordinate directly with the anti-immigrant movement, which is one of the reasons that we had started looking at them. And together they exploit existing anxieties about security and changing demographics to demonize, marginalize, and advance discriminatory policies against Muslim Americans. So, told you a little bit about who they are. Let me tell you what they do and how they approach this. So this movement deliberately uses the legislative process to manufacture fear of Muslims. David Yerushalmi, the author of Model State Legislation, American Laws for American Courts Model Act, restricts judges from consulting religious or foreign law or anti-Sharia bills, as Stephanie mentioned earlier, and he's admitted these laws are designed to pique suspicion. It's designed to shift the cultural conversation with regards to Muslim Islam, and not necessarily designed to be passed into law as written. So the goal is to mess with people's heads. Since 2010, 39 states have introduced anti-Muslim legislation. 194 bills were introduced. 19 were enacted in Louisiana, North Carolina, Texas, Oklahoma, and Tennessee, but 175 were not. Of the 194, 139 bills use the language that David Yerushalmi came up with. Layer on top of that, there have been some state refugee bans and state laws enacted to make sure that, again, Muslim refugees are not welcomed. Second approach that they use, a tactic that they use often, is they oppose new or expanded mosque construction. And that is often, again, coordinated efforts between local activists and national strategists. So it's not often spontaneous grassroots organizations. So this mythology that there's some community that's uncomfortable is a little incomplete. They are working side by side, hand by hand, and making sure that that is, again, designed to play on this notion that that's other. It continues to other the Muslim community. You know, national security, immigration, surveillance, detention, deportation is the frame, the go-to frame for this movement. And part of it is because they're smart enough to know that it works. And part of it is that it's where we are as a country. And so they're not going to get a lot of pushback from people who are saying that these ideas, these laws, these policies are racist or xenophobic, because at the end of the day, they can argue, well, don't you want to be safe? And so even liberals can get caught up in this dynamic. And so I also want to make sure this, we understand this is not a conservative versus a liberal conversation. It's a conservative and a liberal conversation, particularly when you get into the spaces around national security. Liberals are equally as guilty as having this conversation without understanding what it is doing to communities. So we have to be very careful. And so again, this is all happening at both the federal level, 45s, Muslim bans. Before that, we had National Security Entry and Exit Registration Systems, NANSEERS. The rolling name around countering violent extremism and the things that it's doing to, again, have communities be continued to profiled, hyper-surveilled, and ultimately it's government-sanctioned humiliation and isolation. And we could have a whole program on the media bias, because it's everywhere. So we don't have to do that. But again, I want us to be careful. And this, again, this is where you can find all of us are trapped in the images that we see and the images that we don't see. And so the Muslim community is far too often portrayed as either terrorist or victim and not much else. This online echo chamber, we can't blame it all on social media, but we can acknowledge that the dozens of online articles and the absolute hideous targeting that's been going on, the web-based hatred has grown, and that's all part of it. And I also need to note that while SPLC counted bias incidents, they did not count anything online. So we have no idea how much went on between the election and what's going on now. We know it was horrible, and we know it continues to be horrible, but we don't have the numbers. We've talked about hate crime and violence, but I just want to add to this conversation that it's not just Muslims who get caught up in that. It's people who are perceived to be Muslim. So we also have to be very careful. And also that while we are often drawn to talking about very large incidents, we aren't necessarily mindful of the day-to-day microaggressions, the constant harassment and threat that is often goes unnoticed and ignored and unreported. So for all the numbers we have, there's a whole lot of numbers we don't have. So law enforcement training. So one of the things they do, and again, it feeds off this national security thing, and this is a screenshot from our latest effort, report, I don't know what to call it actually, but it's an interactive timeline that looks at what we're calling Islamophobia Academy. And so because we don't have, as a country, universal standards for supplemental law enforcement training, law enforcement agencies can hire just about anybody as an expert. And again, post 9/11, there was a new wave of people presenting themselves as counterterrorism experts. And they have created a whole another industry that is all about personal biases and further vilification of the Muslim community and has nothing to do with counterterrorism. And John Guandolo, who is the consultant that runs Understanding the Threat, has been doing this for a minute now and continues to do it. And we have an ongoing timeline that goes as far back as 2010. And I'm looking at my colleague, go, is that right? and most recent, so it's got some recent dates up here. So you'll note that there's going to be one next week in Mesa, Arizona, and then there will be one in June, and there's one above that that's also in June. And so we do this again so that people have the information to push back, because not only are tax dollars being used for this, not only are police officers getting continuing education credit and becoming more professionalized, it is feeding into a whole lot of state-sanctioned violence, not only on the Muslim community, but on the immigrant community, the refugee community, and the black community, and the trans community, and the gay community. And so it's also a way for us to look at the intersections between all of our struggles, because this is real, and it's happening all over the country, and it's not a federal process. This is happening at the state and local level. And so I want to show you another one, which is Daniel Pipes. And so Stephanie did a brilliant job of telling you about Daniel. But I want you to know that Daniel is kicking it on Capitol Hill. So on April 27th, he was joined by Representative DeSantis from Florida and Representative Johnson from Ohio for the launch of what they're calling the Congressional Israel Victory Caucus. Both DeSantis and Johnson are actually also really anti-Muslim. And according to their press release, this new caucus builds on ideas promoted by the Middle East Forum. And he also, at this moment, promoted a new policy paper on Israel, which is called The Way to Peace, Israeli Victory, Palestinian Defeat. And in it, he argues that Palestinians killed by Israelis should be secretly buried in unmarked graves, that their homes and land should be seized, and that Israel should shut off water to Palestinian civilians in retaliation for acts of violence. Exactly. And so he also writes that if an attack occurs, Israel should strike back against the area from which it originated. So again, quite the call for, if not a war crime, certainly it is in violation of the Geneva Convention. And the reason I wanted you to see this is because I want also, the title of the presentation is Extreme, Not Fringe. I don't want you to believe that their extremism keeps them from the playing field. So while we did this with Empire Change, which is an activist arm of the Muslim community, to do a petition that basically told the Congress people, do not do this, please don't do this, please don't do this, and we were able to minimize the people who came, this Victory Caucus is going nowhere, and he has the, he is sitting in the places of power. He is not alone with that. Next slide, please, Leslie. There's a bunch of them sitting. And so another resource that we have on our website as well as our blog is Nativists at the White House. And we did this in December. And Caleb is, again, going to have to remind me, it's at least 25 of them. And every day we walk into the office and go, okay, who's left and who's gone? So far the only one who's gone is Flynn. So while we can celebrate that, there's a bunch left behind. And not only are these people anti-Muslim, they're also anti-immigrant, anti-gay and lesbian, anti-trans, anti-anybody who doesn't look and sound and act like them. And Mike Pompeo is at the CIA. Jeff Sessions is in the Department of Justice. They just recently, Chris Kobach, who's the harmless-looking gentleman with the crew cut, is the Secretary of State of Kansas, just got appointed to the Vulture Integrity Commission to make sure that that scandalous voter fraud stops. And this man has essentially, I won't say single-handedly, I'm not going to give him that much credit, but has gone out of his way to make sure that, again, brown people don't get to vote. And so I don't think he cares what brown people don't get to vote, but he's clear that brown people are not going to get to vote on his watch. And so I'm going to stop there so that we can get to the other rest of the conversation and get to some questions. But I just want to remind you that if I have conveyed nothing, there are two things I want you to remember. Extreme, not fringe. So the next time somebody tells you these groups are fringe and we should not take them seriously, please stop them. Please correct them, because that is not true. And they didn't just walk in the door with 45. They've been biding their time, and they certainly are energized, and they're not going to go away when 45 leaves, because the second thing I want you to remember, it is operationalized, it is organized, and it is well-funded. Thanks.
Hello, everyone. I just want to thank JVP for having me here tonight. And as somebody who is part of the community that this whole conversation kind of centers around, I'm very grateful for the support from everyone and the concern as well. So I'm going to kind of talk about the effects of this Islamophobia and the relationship to Zionism and the what we call faith washing or creeping normalcy. So creeping normalcy is the way to major negative change, which happens slowly in many unnoticed increments and is not perceived as objectionable. So engaging in interfaith, quote, interfaith activities with Zionist organizations that insist that Jews and Muslims won't discuss Palestine but focus solely on domestic issues as a way to normalize the occupation. So, you know, talking about matters related to faith and leaving that kind of on the side. But this is framing it as if there is a religious tension between Jews and Muslims, which is not the case. And if the tension exists, it's solely political and stems from the occupation. So I have a quote on the next slide from the David Project regarding this idea of creeping normalcy. So it can start as grabbing a cup of coffee with leaders representing other student groups and ultimately lead to joint programs. Support for anti-Israel causes then becomes unthinkable. So it's kind of a slow process where you kind of sideline this issue and get to know each other, you know, as people around some other topic. And then, you know, it tends to stifle this debate or the discussion surrounding the occupation. Another term that we use is faith washing, which is an attempt to legitimize Israeli policies by engaging in interfaith cooperation that comes with an agenda, such as paid trips to Israel. So some of you may be familiar with the MLI, the Muslim Leadership Initiative, which takes Muslim American leaders on this trip to Israel. And one of the participants, Rabia Chowdhury, wrote an article in Time magazine titled, What a Muslim American Learned from Zionists. And so in a critique of this article, another journalist wrote, the Time article reduces the occupation to the displacement of dialogue and both sides being unwilling to speak outside their own bubbles. And so this was something that really had major implications in the Muslim community as far as those who were supporting it and those who were speaking out against it. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a bit. So how do these institutions operate? They devote resources to silencing work for Palestinian rights and justice. They're highly organized and fully funded, as we've heard. They're heavily involved in lobbying, which we've also heard. And they're broadening their base of support by appropriating grassroots methods and social justice movements. So this is basically the foundation for creeping normalcy and faith washing. So in addition, they attack Palestine solidarity activists and organizations through creating backlash, through litigation and economic coercion, collaborating with the government, anti-terrorist activity used to attack solidarity and dissent, which was also mentioned, obviously disseminating and funding the Islamophobia Network in the U.S., pushing for anti-BDS campaigns and legislation, which we've seen here in Illinois and other states, the appearance of groups like Canary Mission, which target students who are active for Palestine, publishing their photos and quotes or supposed quotes from them in an effort to blacklist them, you know, when future employers or whoever, you know, search their names, these things will come up, and other means of, you know, stifling dissent. Recently, I had somebody send me a contract that they were to sign for a convention center to rent out for a prayer. And one of the stipulations in the contract was they may not engage in boycott of Israel, thrown in there randomly. It had absolutely nothing to do with anything. So it just kind of gives you an idea of how they're operating. Another example is before the Presbyterian Church voted on divestment in 2014, the Ecumenical Interreligious Working Group contacted several Arab, Muslim, and Palestine solidarity groups with a, quote, working paper positing a solution for Middle East peace, and it forwarded, obviously, the Israeli narrative and was considered highly inaccurate and offensive to Arabs and Muslims, and it was basically created with input from the Jewish Federation, which had been working to stop the Presbyterian divestment. So there's been a paradigm shift. So no longer is the attack focusing on, you know, bringing publicity to certain issues, but rather it's kind of this targeted outreach and taking this approach to foster an atmosphere of peace where, you know, Israelis and Palestinians can live in harmony, but kind of ignoring the whole discussion of the actual occupation. So we have, you know, the slogans about peace and coexistence and none of the talk of the injustice that's occurring. Another issue is the co-opting of Muslims. So a lot of major organizations have been co-opted, and some of the newest tactics are to engage Muslim leadership in conversations that, for example, frame Israel's attack on Gaza as a war between, quote, moderate Muslims and extremist Muslims. And so I have a quote there saying, first, this is not a war between Israel and Arabs. This is not a war between Muslims and Jews. Rather, it is a war between moderation and extremism. modernity and medievalism, civilization and barbarism. At the same time, Muslims in the West who have lately been indulging in harsh anti-Israel rhetoric over events in Gaza are operating on outdated perceptions that Muslims in the Middle East have largely discarded. So we have kind of this framing of the issue as, you know, the extremists or the terrorists on one side and the modernists on the other. And so those who advocate for Palestinian rights and against war are kind of framed as radicals. Those who dissent are the, quote, bad Muslims who are seen to align with these extremists and, quote, terrorists. And Muslims who remain either quiet on the issue or maybe do engage or choose to engage with Zionist groups are accepted as the mainstream or moderate good Muslims. So we even saw Netanyahu frame some of his rhetoric surrounding Israel's, quote, problem as part of the greater war on Islamic extremism. So something, you know, that Americans can identify with is this this threat of terrorism. So this is one of the effects of creeping normalcy. So the Muslim Leadership Institute is, like I mentioned, a perfect example of this faith washing. And so this organization, the Shalom Hartman Institute, takes young Muslim leaders on an all-expenses-paid trip to Israel to learn about Judaism. That's the, you know, purported point of it. And so it's financed by, in part, by the Barry Foundation, which also finances the Islamophobia Network in the U.S., and it obviously violates the call for BDS as well. And so as, you know, different leaders had come forth in the Muslim community talking about their participation, obviously this had huge kind of shockwaves in the community, particularly on social media. And so some people did not want to come forth and say that they had participated, while others were kind of proud and used their platform to talk about their experiences and kind of champion themselves for attending. And so it really kind of worked to sort of sow this intra-community discord. And those who were against, you know, people attending such a trip were seen again as sort of radicals, a fringe voice, angry people on social media. These are some of the things that we heard, as not representative of the greater Muslim community. And so it's kind of had forced, you know, especially Palestinian Muslim Americans to kind of confront these two identities, and where it was something that we never saw being Palestinian and Muslim American as being at odds with this issue, it created that sort of an atmosphere like, you know, which side am I going to choose, or who do I belong with, where it should not be that way. It also sidelined Palestinian Christians, who, where do they fit in this whole thing, you know? So it's framing the entire thing incorrectly. And obviously the marginalization of the Palestinian narrative through the whole thing. So something that a professor at Stockton University, Dr. Kazi, talks about in one of a TED Talk that I had watched is this connection between Islamophobia and Islamophilia, where whenever there is this prominence of Islamophobic rhetoric, there is this converse Islamophilic rhetoric, but for specific type of Muslim. So that fits this image that, you know, wants to be portrayed as the, quote, good Muslim, you know, whether it's in the media or in our pop culture. So it's, you know, the one who, like I said, is either silent on these issues or engages with groups that, you know, are Islamophobic or Zionist, versus those who have bad Muslim politics or those who dissent to those who speak out against these social injustices. So it's kind of this divide and conquer strategy within the Muslim community. And so those who were critical of the voices who were against these initiatives focused more on how people were framing the discussion rather than what their actual points were as far as why they were against things like, you know, the MLI program or others, saying that, oh, they weren't respectful, or, you know, they weren't approaching it, you know, in the right way, when that was not, you know, the issue that was at hand. And so lastly, I kind of just wanted to touch on, you know, the idea of solidarity. And so this was, you know, even more so addressed within the Muslim community, that, you know, solidarity is not minimizing somebody else's pain in an attempt to understand a racist ideology. Solidarity is not maligning disagreement and portraying it as unfounded or having no basis. And solidarity is not usurping someone else's voice without their consent and acting on their behalf. And so you can't tell somebody how to feel or what, you know, they should be offended by or they shouldn't be offended by. That's something that they are to decide for themselves. Thank you.
Hello again. So I'm going to very quickly talk about some of the campaign goals for Defund Islamophobia, and then we'll go into our pretty extensive Q&A section. We wanted to leave a lot of time for Q&A because we can't have a campaign if people still have questions about it and don't know what it's about. So that's why we're here. So we have sort of two sets of goals for the Defund Islamophobia campaign, what we're looking for from the JUF, and when we don't expect to get what we want from the JUF anytime soon. And so we have sort of a parallel set of goals for what we're going to be doing to make sure that we do eventually get what we want from the JUF. So our stated campaign goals in the Defund Islamophobia report are threefold. So we want, and they're up here in really nice big text, if you don't want to listen to my voice and just read them instead. So we want the JUF to immediately cut off all funding to anti-Muslim hate groups through donor-advised funds or other funding streams. We want, number two, the JUF to commit to rejecting future contributions from funders that are contributors to anti-Muslim hate groups. And three, we want the JUF to make a written and public statement addressing their funding of anti-Muslim hate groups and affirming their commitment to the above actions. So these are our initial goals. This is what we want from the JUF. We want this because the JUF has repeatedly said that they're trying to work alongside Muslim leaders and that they stand against Islamophobia. We know that that's not true, and if it is, then it's lip service. You cannot work to stop hate while simultaneously funding hate. And so we're trying to really send that message very strongly to the JUF that if they're actually going to be an organization that stands against Islamophobia, then they have to stop giving money to people who are in the government perpetuating Islamophobia on a national scale and on a massive level. And so this is what we want from the JUF. These are our explicit campaign goals. We want the JUF to stop using the name of the Jewish community and the money of the Jewish community to fund radical but mainstream bigots who are doing everything in their power to malign Muslims and Arabs and make life impossible for them in the U.S. This is what we want. We have another set of goals. Awesome. We have another set of goals that we're going to be focusing on right now and for the foreseeable future until we do get what we want from the JUF. So ideally, they're going to capitulate to our demands. They're going to say, you caught us. Whoops. They'll pull the money from anti-Muslim hate groups, and they'll promise to never, ever do it again now that we caught them being assholes. So until that happens, and we know what the JUF thinks of Jewish Voice for Peace. They're not our biggest fans. And so we're trying to drum up widespread support in the Chicago Jewish community by bringing awareness to the fact that when people and organizations and programs accept money from the JUF, they're accepting the same money that is going to actively harm Arabs and Muslims. They're accepting money from the same organization, the same organizations that are working against the people that some of these other people are trying to stand in solidarity with. And so we are doing three things currently to drum up this support, to proliferate this campaign, and to pressure the JUF into meeting our other three goals. So first, we're contacting organizations that accept JUF funding and asking them to either make a statement saying, we're accepting this money, but we don't think that what you're doing is right, or to consider refusing their donations outright if they're in a position to do so. This is because if organizations refuse JUF money or refuse to be affiliated with the JUF in some way, then the JUF rapidly starts to lose its relevance and lose its reason to exist. One of the things that they're really trying to do right now is throw money at unaffiliated Jewish millennial groups in an attempt to say, look, the youths care about us. The JUF is going to be relevant for a long time. And so one of our big arms of this campaign and of this goal is to try and reach out to these groups of unaffiliated Jewish millennials and say, no, 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 don't take this money from the JUF. They're doing these things and they're going to claim your bodies and your identities and your acceptance of their money as a reason why they should keep existing and keep funding Islamophobia. So number two, we're going to continue doing actions and campaigning to raise awareness around how the JUF distributes their donor funds and distributes their money to Islamophobic hate groups. We have this really wonderful, gigantic receipt that we were not able to extricate from an office upstairs that we're going to bring around and shove in JUF officials' faces. It's on the wonderful little flyers that you're going to be getting afterwards. There's a small picture of it so that you can see. You can see it and imagine what it would look like if it were 10 feet tall. So we are going to be bringing this receipt around and doing actions and campaign press conferences and call-outs at pretty much every JUF event that we can find and that we can get into, letting the JUF know that, you know, this wasn't a one-and-done press conference and a release of a report. JVP, our allies, our accomplices, and the entire Chicago activist community is going to be on them until they stop funding Islamophobia and until they promise to never do it again. And so we're going to keep on them, and we're going to keep keeping on them, and we're going to make sure that they know that wherever the JUF is, JVP will be there too, and they're not going to like that we're there. And so our third goal, our third action-oriented goal, is we're going to get voices in the Chicago Jewish community to ask with us why the JUF is funding hate groups, and we're going to get those voices to grow louder and louder and more numerous. Because we in JVP can, you know, call the JUF hypocrites and bigots all day, and they're not going to listen to us. But if we can get 5 or 10 or 50 synagogues to stand up with us and say, hey, wait a minute, why are you funding these anti-Muslim hate groups? You also give money to us, and we don't support funding anti-Muslim hate groups. The JUF will listen a lot more to synagogues than they will to us. They'll listen a lot more to Jewish youth groups than they will to us. And so we're trying to build a broad coalition of support behind getting the JUF to stop these shameful actions and to finally defund Islamophobia. So we're going to move on to the question, answer, and discussion portion. And Leslie, you're going to moderate that?
Yeah. And just one other thing that I wanted to mention. So in the report that we released in March, we focused on Investigative Center on Terrorism and Daniel Pipe's organization. One of the goals was refusing funds from contributors to the JUF who contribute to anti-Muslim organizations. We've also been looking at some of the foundations that are major contributors to the JUF and some of the leadership of the JUF. So Lester Crown, Andrew Hochberg, the Gidwitz family, and looking at their contributions. And all of them, all of their family foundations support not just the Middle East Forum and Investigative Center for Terrorism, but pretty much every organization that Terry showed us pictures of. So people in the JUF leadership and their family foundations support Act for America. They support David Horowitz's Freedom Fund. They support the Clarion Fund. Really, I think pretty much everyone that she mentioned. So it's not just Middle East Forum and the Investigative Center on Terrorism. It's much, much wider than that. So as Stephanie said, you know, we definitely want to have questions and discussion. I think I can. So if you want to stand up and say your question really loud, and I can repeat it if need be. Yes, sir.
Hi.
Okay, so in case anybody didn't hear that, are we reaching out to non-Jewish activist organizations? I think the goal of this campaign is primarily the Jewish community, because JUF does claim to speak for the Jewish community, and because we feel that there are a lot of very progressive Jews who are in organizations that are funded by the JUF, organizations like Avodah and JCUA, that would be extremely distraught if they realized the extent to which the JUF is funding hate groups. So I would say our primary focus is on contributions from the Jewish community. And also, this is kind of starting with the Chicago Jewish United Fund, but you know, there are federations across the country. I mean, the Los Angeles Jewish Federation was recently found to have funded Act for America, which is one of the serious wackadoodle Islamophobic organizations. I mean, Bridget Gabriel is just just bats. I mean, she's just bats. But she's very dangerous, as Terry said. I mean, she's extreme but not fringe. There is a group in Des Plaines that has a regular Act for America meeting, and there was a bomb threat at the mosque in Des Plaines around the same time that there was supposed to be an Act for America meeting. So, you know, this is very seriously frightening stuff, and the Los Angeles Federation is funding it. So JVP had kind of asked Chicago to take the lead on this, but I think you'll see activity in other JVP chapters targeting other federations. And I don't know if anybody else.
Yeah, we in Chicago are focusing on the JUF right now because mm-hmm. we can't exactly go to, you know, the Los Angeles office of Act for America and say, you're getting money from Jewish groups, we're going to expose you to the Los Angeles Jewish community because they're not going to care what we say in Chicago. Mm-hmm. As the campaign expands and as it goes to national JVP, and as we partner with more and more organizations, the reach will become larger, but we're in the very beginning stages of the campaign right now, and so we expect it to be a larger defund Islamophobia mm-hmm. campaign, and our hope is that this won't just wind up being a JVP campaign, but that progressive Christian organizations will take it up and progressive mm-hmm. secular organizations will take it up and stop accepting money from anti-Muslim organizations and stop giving money to anti-Muslim organizations as well. But right now, in the very beginning stages, yeah, we are focusing on the JUF because that's our reach and that's what we can do.
Right. Yes, sir.
I could see where your strategy might have a positive effect. However, I'm a little bit confused about the existence of JUF. I mean, Zionism, the idea of Zionism was to displace the Palestinians from their land.
Mm-hmm.
And the JUF always supported, you know, settlement of the Jews on Israeli, you know, in Israel before it was Israel and mm-hmm. it was Palestine. So really, I don't see a moral justification for the existence of JUF. Would you like to comment on that?
You should maybe ask Stephen Nassetier about that. So I would say, although this campaign is not primarily about Zionism, I mean, JVP obviously has a lot of issues with Zionism, and Deanna spoke very eloquently about the connection between the activism around Zionism and Islamophobia. But I think one focus of our campaign is to say, even for those who consider themselves Zionists, and there are a lot of people in the Jewish community who would consider themselves liberal Zionist or progressive Zionist or who accept Zionism, although they don't accept the occupation, even if that's your orientation, your political beliefs, that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to demonize Muslims and Palestinians to do that. We're finding, Terry was talking about the connections. So Steve Emerson of that investigative center on terrorism, you know, the no-go zones in England where Christians are afraid to go, he's on the board of Stand With Us, which is a very active pro-Zionist organization. And he has been on the board of Birthright. So, and we're finding that these sort of connections are not that unusual, that a lot of the same people that are very involved in explicitly anti-Muslim organizations are also on boards and major contributors to very active Zionist organizations. I was finding that all of those family foundations that contributed to Act for America and Middle East Forum, et cetera, just about all of them were also contributing to Stand With Us, to Friends of the Israeli Defense Forces, to Birthright. So this is not coincidental. I mean, obviously, the two movements are kind of working hand in hand. But I think it's possible for someone who is a liberal Zionist to still say, okay, we may support contributions to Birthright, but that doesn't mean we have to support contributions to Act for America or Middle East Forum. So I don't know if that answers your question. Sasha.
I know it's early in the campaign. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So there are a number of unaffiliated groups that we're still trying to identify. We know that the JUF does throw money out there at unaffiliated groups to try and affiliate them. One of the ones that I've identified so far and have talked with some of the folks who are in this room about is a thing called Open Table. One Table, which is an organization that accepts money from the JUF. but that doesn't have any sort of political or like even necessarily faith-based mission. It's an organization that just exists to get young people to do Shabbat. But they accept money from the JUF, and so by accepting that money from the JUF can then point to this organization and say, look, these young people support the JUF by taking our money. One of the things that we're trying to do is we're trying to contact these organizations and say, you know, you can ultimately, at the end of the day, do whatever you want to do and accept donations from whoever you want to, but if the JUF is giving you money, this is what this is, you know, these are the other people that the JUF is also giving money to, and you're being linked to them through that common donor. And we are hopeful that, especially some of the young affiliated people targeting organizations, will have a serious issue with the fact that the JUF is trying to fund them, but also trying to fund Steve Emerson and Daniel Pipes. And so we've sent out a number of calls to larger organizations. We're going to start narrowing our lens to some of these smaller organizations soon. But our hope is that things like One Table and other small organizations of young unaffiliated Jews will be some of the first to stand up and say, hey, well, we won't take this JUF money because they're also funding these other people who are bigots. And so that's coming up very soon, but is not quite in the works yet.
Francesco? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so I'm curious because I work for a media organization that gets all kinds of dirty money from like Boeing, MacArthur, you know. Sorry, I don't remember what it was. I've made that argument. We've made that argument about how we shouldn't take that money, but we live in a time, right, where funding is being cut all across the board, blah, blah, blah. I don't know if you've already started talking to people about rejecting funding from JUF, but like, if you have, I'm curious how it's gone. I think that's a hard sell.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a hard sell. And as I think Stephanie said, it's totally unrealistic for, you know, most synagogues and small Jewish organizations to say that they're going to reject JUF funding. But I think it's really different than, you know, getting money from, say, Boeing. Because, first of all, the JUF talks a lot about Jewish values. It talks a lot about tikkun olam. It talks a lot about working in solidarity with anti-racist groups, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, the hypocrisy and the internal contradiction is just so strong with that. And I think the other argument we can make is, even if it wasn't a moral issue, just on a practical basis, to try and work in solidarity with Muslim organizations or African American organizations when they know that you're also contributing to people that are trying to take them down, you're not going to be seen as a legitimate partner in solidarity. And you're not really going to be able to maintain this fiction that you're working for the good of the Muslim community or the African American community or the immigrant community. So just in JUF's self-interest in terms of wanting to be the organization that they see themselves as being, that's a really good reason for them to stop this. And the other thing is, so we didn't talk too much about this, but a lot of this money, it's not so much that the JUF specifically is deciding to fund this, but the people, the Hochbergs, the Crowns, the Goodwitzes, you know, the other people that are supporting JUF, they are using the donor-advised system. So they're contributing to these organizations using JUF as kind of a pass-through. I mean, there's like tax reasons for this. So JUF can simply say, we're going to set a policy that we're not going to facilitate these donations. It's not necessarily that we're not going to make donations, but we're not going to facilitate donations by these other people using us to fund Islamophobia. And it's funny that one of the arguments they often make is, well, this is such a small amount of money. I mean, the JUF budget, you know, they donate millions and millions of dollars. This is just a tiny percent of your budget. Well, if it's so tiny, then just stop it. You know, I mean, why is it so hard to stop if it's so tiny? But also, it's a tiny percentage of the JUF budget, but it's a very significant part of some of these organizations' budget. So in 2011, the Middle East Forum, 12% of the Middle East Forum's revenue, 12% of their entire revenue came from JUF. So that tiny bit of money that JUF is donating constituted 12% of the revenue of one of the worst hate groups in the country. So I think that's something that, you know, like I said, the Avodahs, the JCUAs, the other organizations in JUF that are progressive are going to have a problem with, and if they can't withdraw from the JUF immediately, they can at least make a strong statement saying this is completely antithetical to our values and you have to stop it.
The Los Angeles Federation that donated money through their donor advised funds to Act for America also recently refused to donate money to If Not Now on the grounds that they're an anti-occupation group and demonize Israel. And so if the JUF and other federations can say that they won't donate money to groups that demonize Israel, well, certainly they can say that they won't donate money to groups that demonize Muslims and Arabs.
Right.
That's what they're about.
And if you can stand up or talk a little louder. I mean, I think that's a good idea. Yeah, I see what you mean. So in other words, raising money to kind of counter, I mean, that we haven't really talked about that. That's a good idea. I mean, I would say I used to do Shabbat really cheap when I was in college without getting funding from the JUF. So, I mean, I think at some point you ask yourself how necessary is that really, and how does that work with what the spirit of Shabbat and the ethics of Shabbat are supposed to be about? But at the very least, you can take it and still say to the JUF, we don't see why you're encouraging us to celebrate Shabbat when you're also encouraging us to violate some of the core tenets of Judaism.
I have a question. How about the Pritzker family? Is one that might be researched with Jay Pritzker now running for governor? There may be some leverage there.
Yeah, there. well, first of all, there are so many Pritzker foundations, but yes, they. It's a fairly small percentage of what the Pritzkers give, but yes, pretty much everybody that Terry talked about, one of the Pritzker foundations has funded Act for America, Middle East Forum, CAMRA. But, you know, it's funny, they fund so many things. A lot of these organizations also fund the Southern Poverty Law Center. So they're funding the Southern Poverty Law Center, and they're funding groups that have been criticized by the, you know. But yes, the Pritzkers, and you know, it depends on which Pritzker, but I mean, there are larger family foundations. Yes, they definitely are tied to that network as well. Yeah, sure. So Stephanie and I were down in front of the JUF office, and Aaron Cohen, I think is his name, who's the vice president, came down to talk to us, and he was not really happy to see us, and he basically said that he knows all sorts of bad things about us too, and he's going to be, you know, making sure people know about, you know, how awful we are and everything. And then a week later, Terry and I were on Worldview with Hatem Abudaya from the Arab American Action Network, and, you know, we basically talked about what we've talked about just now. And so then Jake Kath from the JUF and I don't remember if it was Cohen or Nassiter went on Worldview the next day, and basically they said, okay, one, it's donor advised funds, it doesn't have anything to do with us, and you know, we kind of talked about why that's kind of bogus, and it's such a small amount of our funding, and as I said, it's a small amount of the funding, so why not stop it, and it's a big part of the revenue stream of these different organizations. And besides, you know, some of the stuff, oh, you know, maybe somebody said something anti-Islamophobic a long time ago, but we have no knowledge that these groups are really anti-Muslim. Even though, you know, it's like Southern Poverty Law Center, every year they report on these groups. This is not anything secret. These are not small groups. These are very well-known anti-Muslim groups. So basically, no, we didn't do it, and besides, they're not that bad. That was pretty much their response.
Yes, ma'am.
Oh yeah, they said that we were carrying on the blood libel. But yes, ma'am.
They're spilling it.
So how are we going to approach Jewish organizations?
Yeah, you know, there was aggressive Jewish.
Oh yes. I always forget, what does JCUA stand for?
Jewish Community.
Yeah, Jewish Community Urban Jewish Council of
I always want to say it's the Urban League.
Yeah, but that's a very progressive organization that's affiliated with JUF. Avodah is, there are a number that are. And actually, that's one of the reasons we do these programs. So we passed around some of the postcards. If you're not already on our mailing list, if you could fill out one of the postcards and leave it for us over here. If you're part of a synagogue or some other Jewish organization that's affiliated with the JUF, and, you know, we can take our show on the road. We can come to your synagogue. We can come to your organization. We can come to your JCC and talk about this. We travel. Yes, we travel very easily. We can even bring down our ginormous sign that's upstairs, our ginormous receipt, and bring it out someplace. So, yes, I mean, that's kind of the goal, is to have people who are members of organizations talk to their organizations and say, we find this very troubling. Do you find this very troubling? Can we have a presentation on it? Can we talk with our board about either pulling out from the JUF, or if not doing that, at least doing some sort of public statement about it?
I'm wondering if you've discovered any sort of unified end game for these organizations. Are they working towards a final policy of some kind?
I think that's a Terry question.
A final policy?
Well, I mean,
the final solution?
Like a Nazi sort of thing?
Right.
I mean, in terms of anywhere but America.
Yep. That would be it.
Is it explicit? Is it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yes, their goal is explicitly to make America white again. They couch it in a lot of other things, so that's what I meant when they talk about national security, so it's all about, we got to be safe, and in order to be safe, that means they can't be here. They also, because they are intersecting and working along the same lines around immigration, and some of them would like to have no immigration anymore. Certainly some of them are like, we don't want any more refugees here. So, yeah, so it is it's in some ways the Muslim ban is indicative of their end goal. They are trying, if they could deport everybody, they would, but they're certainly trying to close the borders. They're certainly trying to make sure that anybody who does not practice a faith that they approve of gets to do it freely. Anybody who is in their mind threatening what they perceive as an American value is not going to be. So it is very explicit. Now I will say this: the explicitness is again covered in code words and code language, and so they would probably not say out loud. And one of the reasons why members of the JUF can get away with that, although that's a weak explanation, but the idea that they said it at one point, they're really strategic about how they talk about it. So it speaks to the dog whistling that goes on, and so everybody knows what they're talking about, but they are not going to say out loud, I hate Muslims, I hate Jews, I hate blacks, but everything else essentially is what they're doing and saying. So yes, ultimately that is their goal. To take us back to an America that they're comfortable with.
Yeah, and I think it's worth remembering, I mean, both Terry and Stephanie had talked about this, that Daniel Pipes, in addition to all the awful things that he's written about Muslims, his website has described the Black Lives Matter movement as being a terrorist organization, and we had found there was, the New York subway had this trans acceptance series of posters and public relations campaigns. And he said that that was the quote Stephanie mentioned about saying that a trans accepting campaign showed that this was a civilization in decline. So, you know, the hating Muslims is really kind of the tip of the iceberg with a lot of these organizations.
Things that Steve Bannon and those folks Daniel Pipes and Steve Emerson have their ear. You know, these folks are incredibly Zionist. You know, they hate Muslims and they hate Jews, but they're very, very Zionist and take a lot of their policies and leads from Israeli policies and from the Netanyahu government. Largely because they hate Jews so much that they want us to get out and do our own thing. And also because there's this weird underlying idea in their brains that if they can just get all the Jews and the Muslims out of America and ship us all over to Israel and let us do our thing, that we'll kill each other and we won't be their problem anymore.
Right.
They're Zionist as a way of being able to say, well, no, we don't hate Jews, we love Israel. But then they love Israel because they hate Jews so much that they want us to leave, and also they hate Muslims so much that they love Jews killing Muslims, but also love it when Jews get killed. It's a very complicated web.
Yes.
So how do you plan on getting people to even hear you out on this?
Yeah. Well, you know, we definitely got a lot of hang-ups when we called some Jewish organizations and synagogues. But on the other hand, I think one thing that they're seeing is that often these organizations that they want to be in relationship with, these anti-racism organizations and these Muslim organizations, are more open to working with us than they are to working with other people in the Jewish community. So, for example, March 1st, the Women's Day observation, the Chicago Teachers Union specifically said that they wanted a Jewish organization that was non-Zionist, and they specifically asked for us to come and speak. And there was a reason they weren't asking JUF and some of the other organizations associated with JUF. So you're definitely right that, you know, we're not the most popular messenger to a lot of Jewish organizations. But once again, just looking at their own self-interest, that they want to be seen as, you know, being a progressive organization in terms of working on racism and Islamophobia may open the door a little bit. But once again, there are, I mean, I think our biggest resource is those millennial groups that Stephanie and, I'm sorry, I keep forgetting your name. Yeah, that Stephanie and Isaac were talking about, but also the Avodahs, the JCUAs, the progressive Jewish organizations that are kind of underneath that JUF umbrella. But yeah, I mean, several rabbis that I tried to contact just basically sent an email saying back, no, you know. So yes, it's definitely a tough sell. I think, you know, a lot of what Deanna said expresses a lot of what I think JVP's core values are, which is that we are solidly and indivisibly in solidarity with Palestinians. And BDS is something that was called for by the Palestinian people as a nonviolent form of resistance. And all too often when Muslim groups are invited to work in these campaigns, it's as long as you don't talk about Palestine, as long as you leave Palestinians out. And JVP is one of the few organizations, certainly one of the few Jewish organizations that does that. So no, that's kind of part of the package. And as we said, although I think it is possible to be a liberal Zionist and still say you shouldn't be supporting Islamophobic organizations, you have to recognize that there's a close connection. I mean, it doesn't make any sense to really have this campaign without at least acknowledging that there's a reason Steve Emerson is on the board of Birthright and Stand With Us. There's a reason that all these family foundations that fund Act for America also fund Friends of the Israeli Defense Forces. It's not a coincidence. So the short answer would be no.
One of our other partners, the Institute for Social and Policy Understanding, did some analysis of who is most prone to anti-Muslim sentiment. And what they found was the people most prone to anti-Muslim sentiment are also anti-Semitic. And so it's really short-sighted. Because that just messes it all up, but I don't know how you have that conversation. But the danger is that you are essentially funding your own demise. Mm. Well, it's not just people who are concerned about national security. It's the people who are anti-Semitic. The path to anti-Muslim is a direct line. And so that we also have to be mindful of that while we're having these conversations.
I think I would also say that while JVP is not sort of willing to decouple this campaign from our broader, you know, pro-BDS, anti-Zionist message, one of the reasons that we've put this out there as a public report and as public information is not necessarily to reach the leadership of these organizations, but to reach individual people who are more willing to engage with JVP, and whether or not they agree with our politics, they think that this is a campaign that's worthwhile, it's worth supporting, et cetera, et cetera. And so this information is out there, and if organizations who are not willing to work with JVP based on political differences think that this is something that could be taken up because it's something that they support.
Yeah. Well,
yeah, at the end of the day, it's accomplishing our goal of getting the JUF to do this, and we're going to keep pushing to get the JUF to also be anti-Zionist, or at least non-Zionist.
Yeah, well, that's not going to happen. But, I mean, I guess, yes. I mean, we're willing to work with other organizations that are not necessarily on the same path as we are in terms of Zionism, but we're not going to apologize for anti-Zionist stance. We're not going to apologize for our pro-BDS stance. We're not going to stop being who we are. So, you guys have been really patient and been here a long time, and we thank you so much. Once again, if you didn't already get a postcard, there's also pens over there. If you're not already on our mailing list, please fill one of those out and leave it so that we can get in touch with you. If you want to take extra postcards, bring them back to your organizations. That would be wonderful as well. And just want to thank once again Deanna, Stephanie, and Terry for their fantastic presentations. So thank you all so much for coming.